Sometimes, when it feels like all the powers that be are trying to erase you, the best thing you can do is throw a party. Now, lest you think I'm suddenly pivoting and creating a live, laugh, love kitchen sign, don't worry, I'm not. I'm talking about creating safe places. Even more than that, I'm talking about creating places where you can be vibrant, joyful, where you can be creative, dress up, perform, dance, and make yourself into a work of art. A space where you can show who you are and what you can do and be cheered on and embraced for it. For at least two centuries, queer people have been creating these spaces, centered around the art forms of drag and ballroom. Walking a runway among peers teaches people to be themselves, to see the mainstream culture's norms and subvert them, defy them. Ballroom art and performance has been and is an irrepressible act of resistance. How did this particular form of queer art and culture come to be? How did queer people across centuries find solace and support in these underground and public scenes? And how did the magnificent art of ballroom and the houses that formed around it create a powerful form of artistic resistance that continues to defy anyone who tries to erase it?
Learn it and learn it well.
From Rebel Yell Creative, this is The Art of Resistance, a podcast about using writing, music, and all kinds of art to resist the status quo. I'm your host and producer, Amy Lee Lillard, and I'm an author, a podcaster, and middle-aged queer autistic weirdo who's been obsessing over artists who resisted since I was a kid. And today, I'm looking to make all the dangerous art and help others do the same. To find the origins of ballroom, we have to travel back further than we might imagine, to the 1800s. In the U.S. in the early 1800s, when slavery was still the primary economic engine of the South, a group of free black men formed a chapter of the Oddfellows at the Hamilton Lodge in Harlem. The Oddfellow Society was one of those weird societies of men doing, I don't know, men things, and one that was previously all white men. This Harlem group was the first black group. In 1869, the chapter hosted their first masquerade ball, one where men routinely came dressed as women. So this is it. For those who insist we're all going to hell because suddenly we have drag queens and trans folk, the first drag ball in U.S. history is the Hamilton Lodge's ball in 1869. Now, they admittedly started as a sort of lark by the straight men of the club, but it did give an opportunity for supposedly straight men and those in the community to wear drag in public. The balls, which were called Oddfellows Balls, Fairies Balls, and other names that use slurs in today's standards, they grew every year. And they started offering prizes, like the most perfect feminine body displayed by an impersonator. By the way, it's worth noting the origins of the terms that existed then and still exist today. There's debates on where the term drag comes from. Some say it dates back to Shakespeare, when they had men play the women's parts. Dressed resembling a girl, abbreviated in the scripts, was drag. Others say it just refers to how big hoop skirts would drag on the ground. Then there's queen. It could just come from royalty, of course, but it could also come from the old English word, queen, spelled Q-U-E-A-N, or C-W-E-N-E. These terms were used in a derogatory way towards gay people and, quote, promiscuous women in the 1800s. So putting the words together created a powerful, rich, and appropriated term that was just for the Oddfellows. William Dorsey Swan was the first documented person to use queen to describe himself when wearing drag. William was born to enslaved people and was holding private balls in the late 1800s. He was arrested multiple times for, quote, keeping a disorderly house, which was a euphemism for running a house of prostitution. This is drag star Harmonica Sunbeam in a 2016 interview.
Drag comes with power. It also comes with a platform. It also comes with responsibility. And it's all in the way that you utilize those three things. Drag queens can command attention, you know, just by being in the room, without saying a word, just by their presence alone. I think William Dorsey Swan's life really resonated with me, despite the fact that this man was a former slave and had been through a lot. It makes me feel very proud to know that this man, you know, so early on was fighting for rights or fighting for our freedom of expression.
In the 1900s, World War I brought Americans to Europe for brutal battle. Millions of people died for what seemed like no reason. So nothing made sense anymore, especially all the rules that society places on behavior. And in the midst of this time, the government was having another freakout, a moral panic about these lack of norms. So they decided it was time to prohibit alcohol. As anyone with even a casual knowledge of history or basic human psychology knows, you ban something, you make it even more desirable. You create a way of having fun that also sticks it to the man. And in New York during the Prohibition, the epicenter of fun became Harlem. The neighborhood was blowing up with black migrants from the South and black artists from all over the country. Clubs popped up that played jazz, integrated white and black customers, which was not normal, and sold that sweet, sweet booze. So white people started flocking to Harlem. At the same time, as people thumbed their nose at norms and rules, the pansy craze took off.
Masculine women, feminine men, which is the rooster, which is the hen? It's hard to tell them apart today and say.
It was one of those times of contradictions similar to now. Strict moral panic and rules, but also a flowering of underground culture. Suddenly gay and drag performers were all the rage, and flamboyantly gay performances in film, theater, and clubs became the thing to see. One key figure in the drag scene at this time was Gladys Bentley, a blues singer, pianist, and entertainer.
I'll make you menfolk, treat us women like you do.
She was an openly lesbian black woman, performing in a white tux and top hat, singing explicitly about sex with other women. So this combination of things made that Oddfellows Ball the event of the year. At its height, 8,000 performers and spectators showed up at the drag ball, and police were actually there to help, providing security for any out-of-control bad behavior. All of this, all of the 1920s in Harlem and Hollywood, was a grand wild party that ignored all the laws trying to regulate morality. But then, as all parties do, it ended.
to Sugar Hill, way up in Harlem.
In the 1930s, the Great Depression wiped out all that disposable income. The prohibition ended, and all that illicit booze was now legal, but restricted to, quote, orderly bars and clubs, which meant no drag. And just as we see now, in times of economic uncertainty and great fast change, people freak the fuck out. They long for a history that never existed, one of pure morals and the strict rule of law. So suddenly, in mainstream culture in the 1930s, gay men and lesbians were dangerous, perverts, criminals, corrupting our youth. Hollywood even laid down strict rules about what could be portrayed in film, putting an end to the pansy craze. And then the NYPD targeted the bulls, making tons of arrests for indecency, vagrancy, and female impersonation. So the last Oddfellows Ball at the Hamilton Lodge was in 1937. Again, you outlaw something, it doesn't go away. It just goes underground. And so did queer fellowship. In the 1940s, 50s, 60s, house parties, secret dance parties tried to reduce the danger that came from socializing. Queer people could be arrested, fired, banned from government jobs if people found out. So for decades, the balls went quiet. But they didn't go away. And in 1968, a documentary crew covered the drag performer scene in a movie called The Queen. They showed the Miss All-American Camp beauty pageant, which Flawless Sabrina hosted in the 50s and 60s. This is a clip from that documentary, The Queen.
I run these contests all over America, from Boston to the Ozarks. And drag queens are all the same. You get them together, it's like a convention.
It's important to note again that something that started out as decidedly black, the Harlem chapter of the Oddfellows Society and their ball, was increasingly co-opted by whites. White spectators, white performers, and pageant participants. And during the Harlem Renaissance, as the balls grew, for the most part, white performers won out. Only in 1936, right before it ended, did a black queen win the top prize. And then the bias continued. Black and brown queens were pressured to whiten their skin and to create white hairstyles. In that documentary, Crystal LaBeija, a black queen, got third runner-up in the ball. And she had opinions.
She better get the hell back to Philadelphia because she's one of the worst. And where's Miss Sabrina? Because I'll sue the bitch.
Did you sign
any release? No, I didn't sign any release. And if she releases any bitch on me, I will sue the fool. She won't make money off of my name, darling. She can make it off of Harlow and all the rest of the fools that will flock to her. But not Crystal, darling.
It's in bad taste and you're showing your colors and stuff.
I am doing it bad, but I have a right to show my color, darling. I am beautiful and I know I'm beautiful.
So in 1972, Crystal LaBeija hosted the first annual House of LaBeija Ball in Harlem. It was specifically for Black and Latinx gay and trans performers and spectators. And modern ballroom was born. The LaBeija Ball birthed many smaller monthly or even weekly balls because they offered safety and fellowship, but also powerful artistic resistance. So what was a ball like? This is a clip from the 1990 documentary, Paris is Burning.
A ball is the very word. Whatever you want to be, you be. So at a ball, you have a chance to display your arrogance, your seductiveness, your beauty, your wit, your charm, your knowledge. You can become anything and do anything right here, right now, and won't be questioned.
By the way, this song is Love is the Message, a ballroom staple for years, especially in the 1980s. At balls, there were categories, all of which acted as a fuck you to the outside world, because the center was a runway of sorts. But while in fashion shows only white, skinny bodies could show up on the catwalk, in the ballroom, anyone willing to walk could claim that space. Individuals could walk in categories like All-American Runway, Best Dressed, Realness, Face, Executive Realness, Femme Queen Performance. The participants would turn themselves into works of art, painting and fashion and makeup. While the outside world said trans and gay bodies were wrong, inside the balls, they were the epitome of glamour and culture. And then, of course, there was joy. The Black and Latinx queer and trans communities had a place to have fun, to meet others, to find love, to be themselves, maybe for the first time. And more than the balls, there were the houses. Crystal LaBeija formed the first house when she brought together other Black and brown queer and trans people. Often these were very young people kicked out of their homes for being who they were. Crystal was the mother, guiding her chosen family in the balls and outside. Other houses followed, including the houses of Extravaganza, Dupree, Corey, Dior, Wong, Ninja, and Penn Davis. In the balls, house members would compete as themselves, but also as the house. The houses were much more than just the balls. They gave many members a physical home. They protected one another. Mothers and fathers mentored their house children in ballroom and in life. This is Jose Extravaganza from an interview in 2019.
To be part of a house, not to be part of Extravaganza, was family and looking out for each other, looking out for our own and defending our own. I am honored to even be here today to call myself the father of such a beautiful organization. I was 16 years old when I first heard about the ballroom scene and walked down here, as a matter of fact, and saw a whole, like, utopia of a world.
Coming together as groups, they had collective strength. They weren't exposed to violence and marginalization all by themselves. And when they competed in the balls, house members found recognition from their peers, trophies even. In the 1980s, houses became even more important. As the HIV and AIDS crisis decimated queer communities across the country, houses became critical health networks. House members learned about testing and protection. They got shelter when they were sick, and they even had support in clinic and hospital visits. During this time, the balls became places to mourn and remember. And in a time when President Reagan wouldn't even say the word AIDS, ballroom became a place to talk, to defy the silence and shame. Many houses joined with ACT UP. They held special fundraising balls to support members and spread information about prevention and care. Houses were leaders, grassroots activists, and exquisite performers all at once. Any discussion of the art of ballroom has to include one particular thing: voguing. By the way, the song playing now is the Ha dance, frequently found in voguing competitions in the late 80s and 90s. So, voguing was a ballroom category, and it originated from imitating model poses seen in Vogue magazine. But the moves of voguing pulled in pop, dance, sculpture, military march, and impressive dips. This is another clip from Paris is Burning, featuring Willie Ninja.
I make my hand into a form like a compact or makeup kit, and I'm like beating my face with blush, shadows, or whatever to the music. Then usually I'll turn the compact around to face that person, meaning like almost like my hand is a mirror for them to get a look. Then I'll start doing their face because what they have on their face right now needs a dramatic makeup job. Like break dancing, the dance takes from the hieroglyphics of ancient Egypt. It also takes some forms of gymnastics. They both strive for perfect lines in the body, awkward position, but it goes one step further. It's starting to make a name for itself, but I want it to be known worldwide, and I want to be on top of it when it hits.
And then in 1990, Madonna released the song Vogue. It referenced ballroom moves, and the video included members of the community, like Willie Ninja. Suddenly, everyone was voguing. Even cis white teens from Iowa, like me, were copying the moves.
Strike a pose.
Voguing spread, but the context, the resistance, and the communities who made it were not. Vogue was sort of a novelty, a fad. Fashion designers and runway shows used ballroom moves, and ads used them to sell insanely expensive clothes. It was a dance trend, like the twist or the locomotion, sanitized for white consumers, ignoring its history. But while white America vogued for a little bit, then cast it aside for another trend, ballroom continued. The roots of Vogue were still there, still just as important as an artistic method of survival and resistance. And those who needed to see that message got it. Houses and ballrooms spread from Harlem to across the country and around the world. Ballroom scenes now exist in Mexico City, Berlin, and so many more. This is Queen Obiani LaBeija in a 2019 interview.
It's that balance of that ferocity with its softness, soft and cunt, as they say. And the ballroom scene definitely does invigorate that all the more. In order for you to win in the battles, you need to be fierce. You need to give that bitch attitude like, darling, it is me and I am fierce. I am fabulous. I am divine.
We've touched on the 1980s and queer life before. In our episode on Grand Fury and ACT UP, we examined how conservative and right-wing the government was at the time, how big the moral panics were. And beyond even that, when queer people were acknowledged, or the occasional pitying news report highlighted a victim of AIDS, they were always white men. So imagine the excitement of finding a space for you. One built around Black and brown, queer and trans people. One with a physical home and safety. And one organized around artistic expression that acted as a fuck you to mainstream culture. And also imagine the bravery you needed to take part in ballroom, to get up in front of hundreds of your peers and perform, to compete, to withstand being read. You have to develop a very thick skin. You have to develop confidence. And this was something the world was trying to deprive them of because they were Black and Latinx, because they were gay, because they were trans. I mentioned voguing and how it reached even my TV. Imagine this underground art form, born from black trans queens, becomes something that a 13-year-old white girl in Iowa is practicing in her basement. That's cultural power. That's subversive. Yes, it was co-opted. And over its long history, the story of balls and houses, the story of black and brown, gay and trans peoples, the deep history of artistic resistance and survival was often lost. I didn't know about ballroom until my 30s, when I watched the documentary Paris is Burning, and then the show Pose. But despite all that, ballroom continued and continues today. In times like these, when we're experiencing another histrionic moral panic and a massive right-wing backlash, one that targets the most vulnerable, ballroom is an even more powerful form of resistance. When the trans community is under attack, when drag is seen as a lightning rod of culture, when the queer community is losing rights, ballroom is still that important place of fellowship and family. It's a home filled with art and love. And it has been for nearly two centuries. No one can take ballroom away. No one can destroy drag or trans identities or queer people in our entirety. We've always existed and will continue to. And ballroom is one of the ways that people survive and continue to defy the moral panics and the right-wing bullshit. Ballroom is joy, it's art, and it's resistance. The Art of Resistance is a podcast for the artists, the lovers of art, and people who want to resist but don't know how. These stories are designed to help us find inspiration from the past and empower us all to find some hope for today and tomorrow. I'm Amy Lee Lillard, and I wrote, narrated, and produced this show. And there's so much more to this story. At artofresistance.space, you'll find sources, images, and videos for this episode and all the others. Here's an easy way to learn more about art as resistance. Sign up for the free newsletter at artofresistance.space and get stories and tips every week. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.